Okay, this is week six of session whatever. I'm confused by the numbers myself. But in any event, it's our last class in this session. It's our second class in which we explore knowledge. We've gone somewhat systematically through space and time and knowledge. And of course, in one sense, we're just getting a taste. But in another sense, the nature of the TSK vision is that you can step into it fully at any moment and in any facet of the vision. So there are many opportunities here for really wonderful inquiry and exploration. So after this, we take a four-week break. We're going to meet again on January 12th. And you will, of course, receive reminders and so on. Okay. We're talking about knowledge. And I want to start off by going back again to the question of what really counts as knowledge. And I think I said last time that people tend to think they know what knowledge is. We're open to the idea that time is kind of mysterious, that we don't understand it, that the understanding of time that you find in physics is different from our ordinary experience of time. And we tend to think also that the same is true of space. And so we're open to consider other possibilities. But with knowledge, we kind of imagine that we know what it is. And Rinpoche starts off with our usual understandings of knowledge. It starts off in the reading that we had for today. This is at the bottom of page 28. And one of them, of course, is that there's a source of knowledge which belongs to some absolute realm and is not available to human beings. In which case it's not, you could say, very helpful to us. That's not the model. It's important to acknowledge it because that's the model really that most cultures, most times have accepted. But in our culture, we basically make the assumption that we human beings, and to a lesser extent, let's say, other sentient beings, other animals, are the only ones with knowledge, that we live in a universe that has nothing to do with knowledge, that is insentient, as we say. And given that view of knowledge, we find ourselves in a real predicament. On the one hand, our culture has tremendous knowledge. I forget the statistics, but the amount of knowledge that's available in the sense of information, basically, it doubles. It's almost like Moore's law. There's four times as much knowledge now as there was, I don't know, let's say 10 years ago. I'm making that up. But knowledge in that sense is constantly growing, and this is the most knowledgeable culture in that sense that has ever existed. Now you could say there are other kinds of knowledge that our culture ignores, and that's true. But it's probably more relevant to say that that's really not excuse me, that's really not what knowledge means in TSK, or at least that's only one aspect of knowledge. There is a deeper knowledge at work or available. At the very top of page 29, Rinpoche talks about, let's see, that's not quite fair to point to that. So maybe the first full paragraph on page 29, he says, we may discover that knowledge is available in ways we do not now recognize, that there is a different kind of knowledge, in the section, in the paragraph right before the reading for today on page 28, Rinpoche talks about the body of knowledge, and he means, I think, this broader sense of knowledge. And he suggests that we could embody that knowledge, and become friends with knowledge, become lovers of knowledge. That's all a far remove from our ordinary understanding. This is not the kind of knowledge that the TSK vision is interested in. Is not a knowledge that somebody knows. You know it and I don't, or I know it and you don't, or that culture knows it and we don't. Those things may be true. But we're talking about something much deeper. Michael asks an interesting question. He says, are human beings and other sentient beings unique in being knowers? Or might a rock know its rockness? So I'm not sure which answer to give to that question. One answer, I think, would be to say that given the way we've set things up, given the kind of knowledge that we have, rocks don't know. Now, theoretically, you might say rocks know. I mean, you might have a theory of knowledge which says, well, there's this little tiny little smidgen. That's not a word that you're going to find in dictionaries, maybe. A tiny little smidgen of knowledge that a rock has. And even, I think, Aristotle thought that rocks had a certain kind of sentience. Caroline asks a similar question here. How much does the capacity to know depend upon a biological nervous system? And I think there's some openness. I mean, I think in our culture, there's some openness to possible answers to that question, where you say, well, maybe it doesn't. And clearly, the ordinary understanding of knowledge is that it does. You know, that the only things that know are things that have brains, basically. If you have a very undeveloped brain, you know, just a little bump at the top of your spinal cord, then your knowledge is very limited. But people are forever measuring brains. They're trying to figure out how smart human beings, ancient human beings, I mean prehistoric beings, were by measuring the size of their brains. And they talk about whales and dolphins. They have really big brains. There are problems with that approach, it seems to me, because, there are birds, for instance, that have just little pea brains, as we say in English, that are very smart. So that's a different question. And Caroline goes on to say plants seem to know in a certain way without having brains. Yeah, that's what I mean. There's a certain openness in our culture, or at least within the counterculture, let's say, to the possibility that other kinds of beings can know. And that may signal a shift. One way of thinking about our usual understanding of knowledge is that it's just the way that the culture presents it. The same way that culture has an understanding of what counts as time or experiences in time, it also has an understanding of what counts as knowledge. And sometimes, over time, those understandings do shift. So we may be shifting. And that in itself is going to be valuable, because the moment we question our usual understanding, then that questioning, that allowing for another possibility, is in itself a form of knowledge. And that gets us a little closer, I think, to what knowledge is about in the TSK vision. In TSK, it's about a kind of inherent knowledge. One way you can see the difference, what I'm trying to do here is say, yes, it's good to explore these other possibilities for knowledge. And if, in fact, we saw the world in a different way, so that we really, when we walked out in nature, we really had a sense of the entire natural environment as being knowledgeable, that would transform our experience. But it's still not quite what TSK is about. I don't want to go back into second level and third level. That's probably would just be confusing. for me anyway. But in any event, it's not exactly what TSK is talking about, because in TSK, knowledge is more about the act of inquiry or the availability of knowledge or knowingness. And the fact that we have a particular model of knowledge that says this knows and that doesn't is not quite getting at that level. So Michael goes on to explore this. He says, the realms of the unknown, as evoked in TSK, seems to require that there is a knower knowing its own limitations. The unknown seems to be a boundary beyond which the known yearns to expand. I think you could say it that way. That's right. And you know, really, I think the starting point in TSK is always our own position. On page 29 in the middle, Rinpoche says, if we want to understand, so I think we just looked at this. He says, we may discover that knowledge is available in ways we do not now recognize. And then he asks, so how would we do that? And he says, the natural starting point for such an inquiry is the mind. And he means our mind. Right? And I think that one way of thinking about this is that if you say that knowledge is universal, then you'd say in any circumstance, the availability of knowledge consists of everything that we think of as being known and everything that we think of as being unknown together. You know, that's the universe of everything. That's already based on a certain understanding of how we know. But at least the point that I'm trying to get to is that there is this universality of knowledge. And I think Hayward points toward another aspect of that in the comment he makes here. He says, maybe our nervous system is a structure of knowledge, a way of knowing. And I think you could say that. Rinpoche, in a couple of places in the TSK books, talks about DNA as being an embodiment of knowledge. You know, I think it's helpful to look for the ways that knowledge operates in the universe that we usually don't acknowledge because we're bound to this model that there has to be a knower if there's going to be any knowledge. You can question that. And this, you know, the kinds of questions you've been raising, I think are all good and useful questions as ways of doing that. But what I want to do is I guess just move on to the move that Rinpoche makes when he says, okay, we want to be able to explore knowledge. We want to be able to arrive at a greater understanding of knowledge. And he says, and I just quoted this line, the natural starting point for such an inquiry is the mind. For mind is the operator of knowledge as we know it. So that's our ordinary understanding. And immediately there is a mystery, as he says. It's a mystery that mind communicates with what appears in time and space. We don't know, we don't really understand anything about how the mind knows. You know, if you're a regular scientist, let's say, you say, well, when you put together all those neurons and you know, and all the chemical transmitters and so on in the brain, then you just get consciousness. You just get mind. And that, you know, we don't have to explain it. That's just the reality of the situation, something like that. And it's, you know, from our point of view, I think we'd say, well, the explanation maybe doesn't matter too much. We'll look at that in a little bit. But we'd like to know what can we do with the knowledge that the mind has? How can we go beyond that? And in order to do that, we have to understand something about mind. And that's why Rinpoche says the natural starting point is the mind. If you turn around to look for knowledge, you know, if you're just kind of naive and you walk into this universe, let's say, and you say, well, I want to learn about knowledge. Where can I find it, you know, to start my investigation? And the natural place for us is our own minds, because we know that that's where knowledge operates. Now, You might say, and this is related to the discussion we've just been having about whether plants can be knowledge, can have knowledge or have minds, let's say, or rocks. You might say, well, it's not necessarily just the mind that has knowledge. Our whole being embodies knowledge. That's related to Hayward's point about the nervous system being a structure of knowledge. But I'm also thinking here of the kind of knowing that you discover or that you look into when you're doing a practice like Kumye, or some of you don't know Kumye, maybe you could say yoga, those kinds of practices in which we really try to settle into our embodiment. But you want to understand when Rinpoche says the natural starting point is the mind, he's certainly not excluding the body. Again, it's kind of built into our culture, the way that most people talk about it. There's this distinction between mind and body. And mind leaves the body out of account. That's not, I don't think, what Rinpoche is saying here. Actually, it's very clear that that's not what he's saying. Let's take a look on page 31. He says, he's talking about different possibilities for knowledge and awareness. And in the third full paragraph, he says, such possibilities will come alive when we truly realize that the mind is not a tool, that we can operate independent of who we are. For mind to function differently, opening differently to knowledge, we must learn a different way of being. So in the end, we're looking at our whole way of being, which certainly includes our embodiment. And if you look at the exercises in TSK, of course, a lot of them really evoke the power of knowledge through the body. Sometimes through physical movement, but in any event, in a variety of different ways, we are embodied beings, we are whole beings. The mind is intimately related with our way of being in the world. And I think it might be helpful for those of you, some of you are deeply involved with Kumye, and I think that this is a dimension that helps you understand more about the depth of Kumye, but it could be any other practice like that. The physical movements are ways of transforming our way of being, and that in turn is a way of activating the capacity of the mind to know in a different way. So I think that's what Rinpoche is pointing to. Now, this idea of operating the world in a different way has to do with, essentially, you could say, with not accepting, well, you can talk about it, you can always talk in time terms or in space terms. So one way of talking about it is to say, that it has to do with not relying on the dualities of ordinary knowledge. So on page 30 in the first paragraph, for instance, Rinpoche is saying, the mind can investigate the mind. When it does, awareness doesn't have to rely on the structure of subject knowing object. That's the old dualistic way. And he says a little more about that, actually, on the previous page, on page 29. And I think it's important to look at this. Again, he's saying we can't just conduct our inquiry. We want to inquire into knowledge, right? We want to inquire into the time-space knowledge vision. But right now we're focused on knowledge. And he says we can't rely on the usual patterns. This is about five lines up from the bottom of page 29. He says, moving toward from and to, toward getting and receiving, toward interactions between subject and object, all of that is the old way of knowing, the ordinary way of knowing, the would like to move beyond. The point that I want to make here, that it's not just subject and object, but these other structures that we don't usually stop to think about, structures like from and to, and here and there, and getting and receiving. Whenever you make distinctions, and all of our knowledge is absolutely based on distinctions, then you are setting up a particular way of knowing. And that's what we'd like to do differently. We'd like to find a different form of knowing. And one way of describing that is to say that we want a way of knowing that is not cut off from experience, which Rinpoche says here as the goal. You know, these ways of dividing things up, and again, this is the space-centered way of describing it, but these ways of setting things up in terms of this and that, and subject and object, and here and there, and from and to, and cause and effect, and before and after, absolutely all the ways we think we take for granted and really don't see how it could be any different, mostly, all of that can operate. But it's not going to lead us to a different way of knowing, toward a different vision of reality. And that's really fundamental for the TSK vision, you know, is that we are not we're not just questioning subject and object, although that's a really important part of it. You could say we're questioning duality, and we're questioning the way of knowing that relies on making distinctions. When you make distinctions, you're automatically cutting yourself off. Every time you say this, you're rejecting that. You're cutting yourself off from the whole of experience. And that's what we want to be able to question. So how do you do that? Well, as I said, there's a space way of doing it and there's a time way of doing it. We've been talking about the space way, and I'm sure there's a knowledge way of doing it too, but we've been talking about the space way, which is about cutting things up, dividing them up, the here and the there, taking a position, establishing identities. Those are some of the things that we've been looking at. So that's one of the things that Rinpoche talks about in this reading. The other way, the time way, is the one that I want to focus on mostly. We could do it through space. I think in a way it's easier to go through time. And Rinpoche really offers both here. This is one of these readings where, you know, in just a few pages he presents so much. So we'll turn toward time, but first I see that Michael has raised a question here. I wonder if seeing the giver as one who is receiving access to a greater whole can give a clue for other manifestations of dualistic patterns of thinking. So the giver is receiving access. I'm not sure exactly how you have in mind going about that, Michael, but it seems to me a promising approach because, you know, one way to think about these things is if you can challenge the divisions we've made, if you can come back to a kind of unity, then that's a good move. And so to talk about the giver as also the one who's receiving would be a step in that direction. Is that the main thrust of what you're saying, Michael? Right. Right. Okay, so let me just summarize that, because again, the way our system works, or my recording works, is that you don't hear people when they speak up. So basically, the image that I'm going to go with in particular is you know, if you touch the quality of receiving, which comes when you give, you know, the pleasure that you get when you give, you're it's as though you're standing on two sides of this divide of the dualism that I've been talking about. And yes, I think that's a very fine way to proceed. It makes good sense to me. Okay, so I want to talk about time. The first thing that Rinpoche says about that, and of course he's talking about time here in the context of knowledge, but you know, everything builds on everything else. So he talks about how with time there's a problem with the rush of time. You know, we have this linear time which unfolds from moment to moment to moment. And it goes too quickly. We can't ever engage it. He said at the bottom of page 30, a single thought or sensation arises as the carrier of knowledge. It's an interesting image, but we will work with it. But before we can develop the knowledge it contains, the next thought or sensation has already arrived. Mind is bound to the surface of experience, and while this perspective leaves it intimately acquainted with emotionality, discrimination, and judgments, it has no way to go deeper. And he goes on to call that a disordered motion. So this is an image that Rinpoche uses a lot, that we don't really touch the depth of knowledge. And there are places in the TSK book and in Dynamics, for instance, where there are a number of exercises and discussions that relate to this idea of going deeper, how each point can unfold and reveal greater depth, each point in time or each point in space. So that's one aspect, one sense of it. But I mostly at this point want to focus on the idea that time is moving along moment by moment by moment, and that just makes it too quick. We can never take hold of it. And it might sound from that, and I think I want to take a moment to clarify this, it might sound as though the right approach, given that, would be to slow time down. I mean, that would be one way to go deeper, and to relax, and you know, again, kind of evoking the image of a Kumye practice. You let experience unfold in a different way, and then knowledge immediately becomes more accessible, and that's true, and that allows for a possibility for knowing that is very worthwhile exploring. We talked about this in the last session, that even within first-level knowledge, the possibility of other ways of knowing, other ways of experiencing, are very rich, and they open up possibilities that wouldn't be there otherwise. So slowing time down would certainly be valuable. And you might think about the practice of mindfulness in that way. When you relax and accept, then time opens up. And that's fine. But it continues to accept the model, the view of time, which says that time is what unfolds from moment to moment to moment. And I think Rinpoche is talking about something a little different here. He's talking about moving in a different rhythm. And you know, there's quite a bit in the TSK books about the rhythms of time. And I don't feel that I've penetrated very far into what that means, but I have a little sense. And it's important, I think, to recognize that it means something very fundamental. You know, so in the second paragraph on page 31, where he's been talking about the disordered way of minding that we usually have, and the momentum of it, And then he says, is it possible that we could relax this ongoing momentum? So we're back to the idea of relaxing. And learn to be at home in a minding that moves in more stable rhythms. So you might say, oh, stable rhythms. That, again, that has to do with slowing things down. You know, kind of like playing the bass instead of playing, you know, instead of playing whatever, the flute. I don't think that's exactly, I don't think that's what he's saying. Although, again, that might help. Because he goes on to say in the next paragraph, when he's saying, you know, he said, well, could we explore these more stable rhythms of minding? Could we shift our focus from the content of what arises to explore the movement and rhythms of the mind, including the restless momentum through which thoughts and perceptions take form? And that's at that, you know, further on in that paragraph, he says that about, that's the same thing as not staying on the surface, going to the depth, going to what he calls here the silent nucleus of experience. So these more stable rhythms, what he's talking about here is rhythms that are not associated with the content of what arises. So the whole notion of linear time, this happens and then that happens, it's like there's always something new happening, something more happening. And we're just kind of bewitched by that steady stream of happenings. And that's our sense of what time is. And it's always out of control. It's always just jumping around. And we get dragged along with it. And that's because we focus on the content of what appears. What he's saying here is that instead of focusing on the content of what mind presents, what appears to mind, we could focus on the minding itself, right? The movement and rhythms of the mind. And that would include the restless momentum through which thoughts and perceptions take form. So there'd be all these thoughts and other kinds of content that show up, but we could connect with them as one of the rhythms of minding. You know, so it is kind of like thinking of an orchestra, and as all of you probably know, in Dynamics, in the time section, in this book, the preface of which we're reading, he uses the image of conducting time, and he plays with the different meanings of the word conducting, but the image that comes to mind here is of conducting an orchestra. You don't follow out I'm not sure the image works exactly, but you don't follow out the particular instrument and the melody that it's playing. You let yourself be aware of the whole range of rhythms and melodies and dynamics, and you conduct them, without regard to your own concerns, you might say. So if you think of the image of a conductor of an orchestra standing up at the beginning of, or standing up in front of an orchestra, and conducting, the conductor is responsible to the music. The conductor is not really responsible, or is not really trying to get to where he wants to go. And you could think about it that way. The rhythms of the mind are the music, and the particular things that we pick out as important to us are just distractions from those momentums. They take us toward the surface of time where the content level of time. So Hayward asks a question here. He says, so thoughts are a frequency of time? I don't know. I that would be worth exploring. I've never thought about it that way exactly. Do you feel that that's related to what we're saying here? Do you feel that's another way of investigating what we're saying? It sounds good. Yeah. Hey, I see. Okay. Yeah, well, that's interesting. I haven't thought about it that way. But so Hayward is saying, if you think of these rhythms of time as producing certain frequencies, then thought might be one frequency that shows up, and other kinds of experiences would be other frequencies. That would be great to explore. There's many ways to do this investigation. I just noticed, by the way, that I had my volume turned down a little bit. I hope you've been hearing me all right. I haven't heard any complaints. And I'll check it when I do the recording to make sure that I'm audible at all times. And there will be a certain point at which there's a jump because I just turned up the volume. Okay. So that's the notion. We want to turn away from content, which is the surface of time, and go to the minding itself. Right? So that's a form of inquiry. And again, this is not an inquiry that leaves embodiment aside, but it's a special form of inquiry. It's grounded, Rinpoche says, in our inner being. It's grounded in deepening awareness. And in particular, it has to do with turning inquiry inward. That's what he talks about on page 32. So you look at the structure of the knower and the knowing, the conductor, he says here, and the conducting as well. He uses both instances. And you can't, that kind of inquiry is really different from the kind of inquiry that we're used to when we look for explanations, when we look for the kind of knowledge that science is interested in. You know, it's an inward inquiry. It doesn't have to do with content, right? And therefore, it's difficult for us to do. So, at the bottom of page 32, Rinpoche says, we're so accustomed to conducting outwardly. We're always looking out toward what's happening. So there's no direct and simple way to shift to an inward conducting. And if we try to do it, all we do is we turn the inward into something outward. So that's the trap that we need to watch out for. And he's about to give us a suggestion for how to do that, which that I'd then like to practice with for a couple of minutes. But first, Michael has a comment. He says, an orchestra conductor seems to be directing and guiding the energy of the musicians. That image makes me wonder if our relationship with the rhythms of time should be that of a passive observer or one who delves in, waving the baton around with zeal. Yes, I think it's a very good point. This inquiry is not passive. If you think of the image of a conductor, it could be a little bit misleading, I suppose, because you want to ask, well, but you know, we also want to inquire into the conductor, as Rinpoche says here. But when you do this inquiry, when you dive in, you're bringing everything. You're bringing your whole being. You're bringing, you know, whatever resources and capacities you have. Those are a part of the inquiry. It really is. It's not passive at all. So I'm glad you make that distinction. Okay, so on 33, in the first full paragraph, Rinpoche gives us a very important suggestion. He says, the real path inward, so this inward knowing, opens differently. We transform the momentum of our knowing. And this, of course, the momentum has to do with rhythm, the rhythms of knowing, and the rhythms of the mind. We transform the momentum of our knowing outward, that's our usual momentum, when we trace the present arising of that momentum. The dynamic that moves toward the known can also lead to the originating center of our awareness and our knowing. So we trace that dynamic. We trace the dynamic of our knowing. And that's basically what I want to have us do here in a moment. I want to just for a moment point out the distinction here. Here he talks about tracing the present arising of the momentum of knowing, right? Tracing the dynamic. And I want to contrast that to what he says about explanations, which is a little further on page 36. He says, let's see if I can find that. About the eight lines down, or about six lines down from the top, he says, we could offer explanations for what's going on in a certain situation. And he says, but the problem is this, explanations mirror the temporal structures of the conduct they attempt to explain. They track one level of sequencing with another. And I think that's actually a just wonderful distinction. The way of knowing that knows outward wants to explain things. And when it constructs a chain of explanation, it's just repeating or duplicating at a different level the way in which things manifest, that same knowing outward kind of momentum. What we're talking about is a very different kind of dynamic, a different kind of tracing. So let's try to do that as usual. We're kind of running out of time, but I'm going to frame this in a particular way. There's many different ways to describe what Rinpoche has just suggested here. And I think I'll probably send out at least one or post one, I don't know, reflection or something during the break and suggest some of these other ways of investigating, because I think, you know, you could spend these next 4 weeks doing a lot of this kind of inquiry because it's always available. It's always there. And I think it'd be really helpful. But this inquiry which traces the arising of the momentum of knowing. So here's a suggestion for how to do it. Let's do it for a couple of minutes and then give people a chance briefly to comment. Think of it this way. Just let yourself go into your experience, and whatever you see, whatever you think, whatever feeling or sensation you have, just be aware of the act of knowing in addition to what it is that you're knowing. So if you see the painting on the wall in front of you, just be aware of the act of seeing the painting. See if you can do that. Let's do that for a couple of minutes, then we'll take just a couple of minutes, I'm afraid, for comments, and then we'll have to stop. So a couple of minutes to be aware of the act of knowing as well as what it is that you know. Okay, so as I say, we just have time for a couple of comments. I think we'll go on to about 9:50, and again, I know I will say 45 minutes. Okay, so we have a instant comment from Hayward who says, "Seems inseparable." So the act of knowing and the being known seems inseparable. Well, you know, I was just happened to be reading about this in Western philosophy. People sometimes say the act of knowing, the act of consciousness, is inseparable. And the word they use is, they say it's transparent. If you look for the act of knowing, you can't see it. All you can see is the content. Maybe that's not exactly what you're saying, Hayward, but it's at least related. And then the response to that is to say, well, that might be true if you're, I mean, Western philosophy, the response is that might be true or seem to be true if you're looking at, you know, the act of seeing something. But for instance, when you have an emotion or a mood, the act of knowing or being aware of that mood seems to be somehow different from the mood itself. So that's just something to think about as a response. So being inseparable is not necessarily the same as saying being indistinguishable. They may arise, maybe it is, if you take it solidly. I'm not sure. I'm not sure which you had in mind. It all became knowing. Okay, that moves in a nice direction. You know, maybe that's, I mean, that might be a good description for what Rinpoche is pointing towards here, when we're aware of the rhythms of knowing. Then, and I suppose this relates to your earlier thought that thought might be a frequency of knowing, you know, and seeing or experiencing something else would be another frequency. Okay, any other comments, either verbally or in writing? If this practice seems a little intimidating in the sense that you don't know how to do it, I'd say just keep giving it a try. You know, I sometimes wonder why we don't just practice TSK all the time, and I would be the first to say that I don't. I mean, maybe it's certainly a part of me at this point, and perhaps in that sense, it's always involved in what my experience is. But I don't all the time, you know, deliberately engage in exercise, and yet there's no cost, it seems. You know, we could be doing that kind of inquiry all the time, and it seems to me to be very fruitful. So if you have some issues or you know, if you didn't quite know, if you didn't know how to go about doing this exercise, or it doesn't make any sense to you, just keep playing with it. And as I said, over the break, I will post at least one more, I don't know if it's an orientation or a reflection or what, and I'll suggest some other ways you might approach this. Okay, well, good. Then we will stop right there. I wish you all happy holidays, and we'll be back 4 weeks from now. Okay. Thank you.